Sword Palace. Now his formal attire is of sword aristocracy. He could rival my father, Kennet, in elegance. He notices my puzzled expression. I was at a second-born pre-trial event, hosted by a tremendous boar, when I was pulled away. You look nice. I glance away from him, hoping my hero worship isn't apparent in my tone. Who was the boar? Firstborn Harkness Ambersole, he replies. Have you met him? I don't recall. No, but I've heard of him. If Harkness had been to the Sword Palace, I wasn't introduced to him. He's firstborn and I'm secondborn. I was kept away from most social gatherings at the Sword Residence for that reason. Isn't Harkness next in line for the position of the Sword, should either Gabriel or I be unable to claim the honor? He is. Your friend was there as well. He asked me about you. Which friend? I have so many. I lie. I have two, Hawthorne and Clifton. Maybe Raken. Maybe none. I can't decide. They all come with strings. Exo Salloway. He asked me to tell you that he misses you. Was Clifton holding onto the arm of the loveliest diamond-fated starlet in the room when he told you that? My smile is ironic, imaging the handsome Exo Sword with his movie star good looks. He was quite alone this evening, and adamant that I deliver his message. A definite frown accompanies Dune's answer. A year ago, I would have been devastated by any inkling of my mentor's disapproval. Now I'm surprised to find that I'm somewhat annoyed. Clifton has done more for me than I can repay. I miss him too, I reply, wanting to see Dune's reaction. His frown deepens. The transparent elevator suddenly exits the opaque shaft and travels through the open air toward the golden halo-shaped crown that hovers over the rest of the palace. The night sky is glorious with glowing stars. For several moments, all I can think about is how beautifully decadent the City of Purity is at night. From the skyscrapers that hover far off the ground to those that spiral and change their shapes before my eyes, the city shimmers with opulent extravagance. The elevator enters the golden circlet of the Halo Palace, and the view cuts off. When the doors open, we enter a magnificent foyer. A grand staircase climbs to a golden balustrade-lined mezzanine. More than 10 military-grade death drones hover about this lavish room. Several Iano guards in crisp gray uniforms stand like statues at equal intervals in the foyer. That staircase leads to Fabian and Adora's private residence, Dune says, referring to the Virtue and his wife. I peer up. Exo guards in black uniforms stand at intervals along the mezzanine's curved walls. All of them have fusion rifles. Dune must have cleared my moniker for the visit, because our presence goes unchallenged. Golden columns support gilded architraves on both levels. Between the pillars on the mezzanine's landing wall beyond hang portraits of the Virtue and his sublime spouse. Adora's green eyes, wondrous and cold, cast a gaze of emerald ice upon Dune and me. Her long blonde hair gently moves on the portrait's visual screen, held in place by her halo crown, a circlet of pure gold. The difference between the two royal figures is such to make them worlds apart. Where Fabian is dark, Adora is light. His mouth is ruthless. Hers is supple. His face is hard angles. Hers is rounded softness. Dune and I don't climb the exquisite staircase. Instead, we turn and head for an adjacent corridor, our shadows stretching beneath the ever-watchful gazes of our sovereigns until we're out of the foyer. Dune's gait is gentle, the pace of a panther whose tail caresses the confines of his cage. He leads me to his private apartments. I'm impressed by the beauty of his drawing room, everything masculine and high-tech. I approach an arching glass wall with godlike views of the city beyond the expansive grounds. The world almost makes sense from this altitude. Privacy mode, Dune says. I huff in disappointment as shutters of thick steel close over the wall, severing my connection with the outside world. Doors close and latch. A pinging high-intensity frequency bursts to life and ascends in pitch until I can no longer hear it. Dune stands near a luxurious tungsten and black velvet sofa. Large chairs of the same shiny metal and matte fabric face it. He gestures toward one. I settle into it and feel small by comparison. He lifts a silver orb from a glass bowl on the low table between us, holding it in his palm. It levitates and hovers in the air. Light erupts from the device, shining out in spidery legs that expand into an iridescent bubble around us. The orb slowly descends into the bowl. It settles among the other spheres, still emitting the light.
"We are secure," Dune says. "You can speak freely. Not even our moniker's transmitters can penetrate the whisper orb."
"Thank you for seeing me, Commander Codaline," I murmur.
"No need to thank me, or to call me Commander. I'm not your mentor anymore. We both know I'm neither firstborn nor secondborn."
"What shall I call you?"
"Dune."
"Is that your real name?" I'm surprised to hear the hurt in my own voice.
"Yes."
I once thought I knew everything there was to know about this man, but I know very little. "Your last name isn't Codaline. It's Leon."
"You met my brother Daltrey."
"Does anyone really meet Daltrey, Leon, or is he more like something that happens to you, like an airship crash?" "I brought him the monikers that Flanagan and I stole from Census. He accepted them and then left me little choice but to infiltrate the Sword industrial systems for the Gates of Dawn."
"He does have a way about him. He sees your potential."
"Daltrey is your real firstborn brother, is he not?" I ask. "Dune resembles the leader of the Gates of Dawn."
"He is. I had an older sister, Kendall, but she was murdered not long after her transition by a firstborn from the city where she worked."
"I'm sorry."
"As am I."
"Where was her post?"
"In the Fate of Virtues. She had a brilliant mind. She was training to be an energy engineer."
"What happened?"
"She was raped by a man whose father controlled the energy contracts for the region. She became pregnant with his firstborn. He didn't want anyone to know, so he strangled her."
I should be shocked, but I'm not. "Was he punished?" I ask.
"Usually only secondborns suffer the consequences of any crime perpetrated against them by firstborns, especially the crime of rape." "Not by Census. He paid a fine to the Fate of Stars, and they let him go."
I shiver, seeing the intensity in Dune's eyes. He has made pain his companion. I've always felt it, but I didn't know why.
"You avenged her." "It's not a question. He's patient and precise, dark and powerful." "I tortured my sister's murderer, and then I tied his rotting corpse to the trunk of a tree in front of his parents' estate in Lenity."
"Pain isn't just Dune's companion, it's his lover."
"He was virtue-fated?" "Lenity is a wealthy district not far from here." "He was star-fated, but living in virtues."
"Was it enough?"
"As a soldier, I know once the inertia of passivity is broken, crossing the line of violence has its own momentum. Revenge doesn't have a master. It is a master." "His death will never be enough. This republic that allows firstborns to commit atrocities with little or no repercussions, that enslaves us, will end."
The caged animal look is back, darkening his features. It's unnerving. Dune's usually so careful, so controlled. He has never spoken to me like this before, as if I'm his peer.
"It's not your fault, what happened to her," I say quietly. "Isn't it?"
His tone is harsh.
"You saved your second-born friend from a similar atrocity."
"It wasn't the same thing. I was lucky."
"Was it luck? Or was it you being brave? Daring to act despite the consequences?"
"I don't know."
"Nor do I." He paces behind the long sofa, within the Whisper Orb's confines. I clutch the arm of the chair to keep myself from going to him. He wouldn't want that. I clear my throat. Daltrey is the oldest in your family, then Kendall, and then Walther? That makes you technically fourth-born, third-born now that your sister is gone. Walther is older than me, but only by minutes. We're fraternal twins. Twins are rare. If a second pregnancy results in twins, one fetus is terminated and delicately removed or left to be absorbed by the other. With a first pregnancy, the parents can choose to keep both twins, but one must be second-born and eventually given to the government on its transition day. How did Walther become a second-born sword? Walther and I have been a secret since our birth. Census would have executed us both, and our mother for hiding the pregnancy, but my parents were wealthy and made sacrifices to keep us alive. His parents were more than wealthy. The Leons are the second family in the Fate of Stars. They would inherit the title of the Star if the current first family's heirs and stars, the Vukes, were unable to claim the title. In other words, if they were dead. If Axel Vuke and his two children were to die, Daltrey rules his fate as the Star. What sort of sacrifices, I ask.
Some firstborns in the Fate of Swords find the secondborn laws particularly brutal. Secondborn swords aren't just ripped away from their families. They're often slaughtered by war, or they die due to the extreme hardship of being raised as soldiers. Some firstborn swords are unwilling to sacrifice their own child to that kind of brutality.
But they have no choice. The law requires them to have a second child to fulfill their duty to the Fates. If they don't, they lose everything.
In Walther's case, Dune explains, his adoptive sword mother pretended to be pregnant. When my mother gave birth to us, my family paid a physician to assert live sword-fated births. The physician forged all the DNA screenings necessary to provide sword monikers for me and Walther. Walther's adoptive family claimed him as their second-born son so that they wouldn't have to have another child of their own and give it up. In exchange, they receive Walther's earnings as a second-born sword soldier and keep their positions in the sword hierarchy. There's no love there. Walther is a means to an end.
How did your star-fated family manage to keep all this a secret?
Walther's adoptive family took him into their home as an infant and gave him to a mentor to raise. He lived with them in their house. He was brought to a few of their sword family gatherings when he was a very young child, but when he became old enough to train in the art of war, he was sent back to Stars, to my real family, per their agreement. We were 5 years old when I was reunited with my twin brother and began training with my father and Daltrey. We come from a long line of warriors, spanning from a time when there were no fates or laws to decide who or what a person should be. Our mistake was not training Kendall as well.
I've always believed you to be firstborn.
I was more fortunate than Walther. My adoptive family couldn't have children. They tried for years and failed. The Codalines are sword aristocracy. They would have lost their titles and their wealth if they couldn't produce a firstborn. They were desperate for a child. My adoptive mother, Corinne, and my adoptive father, Quentin, were eager for the illegal adoption, even knowing they'd be executed if it were ever discovered. They love me as if I'm their own child. They missed me when I was at my star family home. They demanded visitations. I spent time in both fates. Then they adopted another child in the same way, a second-born girl named Suri. My younger sister came from a star family as well. She was the star's third-born child and would have been killed otherwise. The Gates of Dawn began as a secret movement to save thirdborns from census. It grew from there into the network it is today.
What happened to your sword sister?
Suri was killed, just after she transitioned, at an outpost in Darkshire. Friendly fire, they said. Our adoptive mother cried for days.
Were you close to Suri?
Suri felt more like a sister to me than Kendall. We spent more time together. She had no business being a soldier. It wasn't in her nature. Another note of regret. Maybe another reason why my training was always so brutally rigid. Every lesson, Dune stressed that mastery meant life or death. "How did you come to know the virtue?" I ask. "When I was 18, I was sent to Virtues to be an Ayano guard at the Halo Palace. It was an honor for my sword-fated family. I was one of the Halo Palace's most proficient fighters," the Virtue noticed. "Not long after, Clarity Bowie sent me to the Sword Palace to be your mentor."
"You're a firstborn aristocrat. Why did you take the job? You don't have to work."
"Before he died, my real star-fated father was an aristocratic advisor to the Virtue. He used his influence to plant the seed that I be sent to you to protect the future of the sovereignty of the fate of Virtues."
"You had plans for me even then?"
"Not plans, exactly. We had scenarios. If we could train you from infancy, we'd have another angle of attack."
"Why not Gabriel? Why not train him?"
"You know the answer to that."
"Mother."
"Yes. Your mother only saw him. She never saw you. I could train you any way I saw fit, and she rarely interfered. I could teach you to be strong and decent."
"Do the Codalines know your loyalties lie with the Gates of Dawn?"
"No."
He frowns.
"It would kill them to know."
"If you can pay physicians for monikers, then you don't need the stolen monikers I delivered to the Fate of Stars." He waves his hand dismissively.
"Those physicians no longer exist. They've been routed by Census, one by one. I've been fortunate to have maintained my identity. My moniker wasn't a copycat. When Census converted to the new monikers, my device appeared legitimate. So I was issued a new, upgraded version after mine was rendered useless. Other thirdborns with copycats were discovered and executed. You saved lives by bringing the new monikers to us."
"Only a few. Most of their spies in the field were executed last year."
"You'll save thousands from census agents. All our attempts to reverse engineer the new monikers were failures, but because of you, our agents have access to the Fate of Swords industrial systems. We can create new profiles, new identities for Thirdborns to avoid being senselessly slaughtered. Soon, we'll locate the schematics and encryptions for the new monikers and duplicate them. You've done far more for the Resistance in a short time than anyone could have imagined."
His words don't bring me comfort. Not really. They make me feel torn. Sword soldiers are fighting the rebellion, the Gates of Dawn, as I sit here in a literal palace. My regiment is still in active combat. Conspiring with the Gates of Dawn makes me a fate traitor. When I help them save Thirdborns, I'm helping the very people my Secondborn regiment is fighting against. I'm choosing to save one side from being murdered while neglecting to do the same for the other side. My side. Secondborn swords die every day in this war. My people. Where is their peace? Who will save them?
"Was it worth it?" I ask, my voice taut.
Dune stops pacing. His entire focus is on me. He arches an eyebrow.
"Was what worth it?"
"Killing all those people with your fusion snuff pulse. Was it worth it?" The bitterness in my voice is clear. My eyes fill with tears.
"Daltrey didn't tell you?"
"Tell me what?"
"The attack against swords on your transition day wasn't us."
"What do you mean? I was there. I saw..."
I growl, trying to keep the tears in my eyes at bay. My fingernails dig into the soft fabric of the chair. "It wasn't the Gates of Dawn."
"But even Daltrey said..."
"Daltrey was probably trying to protect you, Roselle. He told me you were fragile when they found you. You were beaten almost to death and barely able to move. He didn't want to add to it."
"What are you saying?"
"Those soldiers, The ones dressed like the Gates of Dawn? That wasn't us. Those were swords dressed as Gates of Dawn. Admiral Dresden's special death squad. Your mother's people. Her spies uncovered our technology, the fusion snuff pulse, and she used it, attempting to kill you on your transition day and make it look like an enemy strike. I shake my head in denial. No! They had on uniforms. They had masks. A tear slips from my eye. She wouldn't do that. She wouldn't risk her firstborns like that. Her reputation.
She would. For Gabriel, she would.
They knew our protocol. They knew our route. They knew everything. If they'd been Gates of Dawn, explain how they got into swords. You let them in, I accuse. You told them where and when to attack us. I would never risk you in that way. Those ships could have easily killed us. We barely survived. You saw my face, Roselle. You saw me. I did see him. He was surprised. He wasn't expecting what happened that day. A part of me believes him. The other part of me feels murdered by what it means, left bleeding beneath the broken ships. Gabriel knew, I mutter numbly, putting it all together. He sent Hawthorne to find out if my mother had killed me. Hawthorne had been told to search for me and make sure the Gates of Dawn didn't take me. But really, that was just a cover so that no one would know the sword did this to her own people, so she could murder her own daughter. Deep down, you've always known it was her, he replies, and you'll survive it. Will I? I ask in the same kind of shell shock that I'd felt that day. Dune squats down in front of me, using his large thumbs to wipe away the few traitorous tears that escape. I'm your family. You're more my daughter than you've ever been hers. Did you ever love her? I wipe my cheeks with my sleeve, relieved when no more tears fall. No, I never loved your mother, but I know you do, even as unworthy of that love as she is. He stands and goes to the bar, still within the Whisper Orb sound bubble. A holographic menu appears at a wave of his hand. A fat tumbler rises from the surface of the bar. Ice clinks inside the glass. Why were you with my mother if you never cared for her? I watch him pour water over the ice from the pitcher beside the tumbler. He turns and faces me. I was her lover so that I could exert influence over her, to make sure that no harm came to you. She was more afraid of you than she was of anyone. The more powerful you became, the more she feared you and the virtue. Why have you brought me here? He walks to me and hands me the glass. I accept it, taking a sip. He sits on the tufted sofa. The virtue knows he has to protect you if they're to have any future. My tears are gone now. I know your endgame, Dune, I reply, setting the glass down on the low table between us. You want complete destruction of the Fates. That's what the Gates of Dawn desires. Why not kill the virtue yourself and have your way? Killing one man or two will do nothing. The regime keeps going. Unless you kill it from within. You can bring us peace, Roselle. An end to the barbaric society we live in. What if I can't? What if I don't want the job? Unacceptable, he growls. His eyes pierce me with a predatory stare, just like they used to when I'd forgotten some lesson he'd taught me. What about Harkness Ambersol? I ask. From what I've heard, he'll kill it from the inside by sheer incompetence. This kind of insolence is new territory for me. I've never spoken to Dune like this in my life, but I find I don't care what he thinks of my tone. You jest, he replies. But you hold the lives of every secondborn and thirdborn in your hands. For Harkness to be in a position of power, you'd have to die. And that is completely out of the question. There has to be another way. You think I want this for you? I tried with everything in my power not to destroy the sweetness in you. If there's another way, I don't know it. His definitiveness scares me. He always seemed to know every angle of every situation. You're talking about the destruction of the Fates Republic. I'm talking about a new world order. One that doesn't tolerate census agents or government-owned slaves. Fear so strong it makes my knees weak courses through me. He means a world without transition days, without people like Agent Crow. I'm afraid of wanting that world, because it's not real, and allowing myself to hope for such a place could crush me. Dune reads my fear. His voice is gentle when he says, "For now, you'll be Grisham's mentor. You can handle that. I'll take care of the rest." "What about Raikin? Did you know he's here, and he hijacked my mechadome?" "I know. He briefed me before I came to find you. He's protection for you. Cooperate with him. He's here to help you." "He's annoying," I mutter. "Is that why you saved him on the battlefield? Because he annoyed you?" "I couldn't kill him like they wanted me to, like a coward would kill." "So you saved him instead. That's why you're the one who will change our future." "I love my brother," I blurt out. "I'll do everything in my power to save Gabriel, but he'll never be the Sword. He'll have to accept that." "He'll never accept it." "Then that's on him. Do you want me to call a medical drone for your neck?" I touch my throat, where my blood has mostly dried. The assassin shouldn't have tried to slit my throat. He should have just stabbed me from behind, thrust his knife through my nape. "You wouldn't have made that mistake," he replies. "I should have killed the third one." "No, taking him alive was optimal. You would have followed him into the water had Raikin not stopped you?" "Of course." This brings a small smile of approval to Dune's lips. "Raikin was right to stop you," he says. "You cannot take risks like that. Your life is very important." Dune and I talk late into the night. He asks me questions about the past year. He's especially interested in Clifton Salloway and the Rose Garden Society. I don't seem to know anything more about the Sword Secret Society than what Dune does already, but I'm not sure, because he isn't as forthcoming with his information about the Rose Gardeners as I am. "You haven't spoken much about Hawthorne," Dune says. "We're friends," I reply with a shrug. I feel very protective of Hawthorne. Members of the Gates of Dawn have been watching us. Daltrey admitted as much. "He helped you when you needed him." "That's how it is when you're a second-born soldier. We have each other's backs." "But he's firstborn now." I don't like what he's implying. "You're basically firstborn, Dune, but you're still loyal to thirdborns." "Be cautious with Hawthorne. The lifestyle of a firstborn of the aristocracy is seductive. The longer he's a part of it, the more he may get to like it." Dune's words anger me, not because he's wrong, but because he's right, and in direct opposition to what my heart wants. The thought of not being able to trust Hawthorne again tangles with the love I feel for him and puts me in an even fouler mood. "I'd like to speak to Hawthorne," I say. "That's not possible now. Trust me, it's better this way." My hands form angry fists, and I rise from my seat abruptly. "If you'll excuse me, the evening has caught up to me, and I wish to rest now."
"Of course. Forgive me for keeping you so long."
I wave my hand, dismissing his apology. "I missed you, and I wanted to see you."
"I'll make time for you whenever you need me, Roselle."
Dune lifts the whisper orb from the table. The iridescent bubble around us bursts.
"I'll walk you to your apartment."
"I can manage it on my own."
"I know you can handle yourself, but I'd feel better if you weren't alone."
"I insist. I'm not a little girl anymore." I'm out of step with our new relationship.
Dune wants us to pull the pin on this world and watch it explode. He's willing to risk everything for change. I'm worried about who will be left standing. Disappointment shows in his eyes. A lot has happened in a year, hasn't it?
At least allow me to walk you to the lift.
I nod. Dune escorts me to the opulent foyer.
Rest for a day, Roselle. Grisham's training can wait.
I'm sure he'll be thrilled to hear that. I retreat into the glass elevator car. When I look back at Dune, there's sadness in his eyes, just like on the day we were forced to part. This man, no matter what he says to the contrary, will always be my mentor, or much more than that. Before the doors close between us, I lurch out of the elevator and into his arms. He squeezes me tightly, resting his chin on the top of my head. "You're my father, Dune," I whisper so only he can hear me. He acknowledges my words with an even tighter hug. When he lets go, I enter the elevator and descend from the halo. Chapter 4. Phantom Star. It takes me a while to find my way back to my apartment from the glass lift. I get confused and lose my way. All the small conveniences of my moniker, such as navigation maps, become huge irritations the moment I no longer have access to them. I finally end up asking an Iano guard for help. He summons a mechanized domestic to lead me to my corridor. The tall, lanky android with its holographic humanoid face and features is foreign to me. We never used them at the Sword Palace. My mother never trusted them, calling them a security liability. She barely tolerated the Maginots. I see her point. If the enemy were to infiltrate automated soldiers, an entire army could be turned in a single moment. If the automated soldiers themselves gained a greater awareness of self, the result could be the same. My apartment's corridor is cordoned off and crammed with Iano guards who have probably been here since just after I reported the attack. One of the guards behind the barrier lets me through when he recognizes my face. Hovering stingers are positioned on either side of the door of my apartment. As I near them, they don't react to me. My moniker is scanned, gaining me entry. Inside the apartment, a swarm of exo-guards investigates the crime scene. Among them is firstborn Jens. She's on the balcony outside, staring out into the garden below. A couple of census agents are also there, recording their findings using databases accessed through their monikers. They were probably called because the corpses didn't have monikers. I stay as far away from them as possible without appearing to. A team of exos and drone cameras documents the scene. They've already removed the bodies. Now they're pawing through everything in the apartment, but it doesn't bother me. I don't have any personal items here because I was taken from the Fate of Swords during the middle of the night and not allowed to pack. Everything I have has been provided by the Virtue. I lean against a wall near the entrance to the drawing room and watch the activity. An hour later, the investigation winds down. Exos and census agents trickle out until only firstborn Jens and a few of her people remain. She comes in from the balcony and secures the door. The assailant's DNA profiles aren't in any of our databases. It's as if they don't exist. Census was called, and they'll be handling that aspect of the investigation. Expect questions from them. Dread over speaking to a census agent makes my stomach clench. Who do you expect is involved? All signs point to Gates of Dawn. I know she's wrong, but I refrain from saying as much because I have no evidence to the contrary. We'll post stingers in the corridor and by your balcony for now. Extra Iano patrols will remain in the garden, but don't expect that to last. Grisham doesn't like a large security presence. He cherishes his privacy. I'll be fine, I reply. Thank you for your help, firstborn Jens. Call me Vana. If you need me, contact me on my moniker. I can't. Mine has been restricted. She points at Phoenix. Then send that little guy to find me.
I don't bother to tell her that it would take Phoenix a long time just to walk down the corridor. I simply nod. Firstborn Jens and the rest of the investigators collect their equipment and hovering transporters and exit the apartment. A small army of mechadomes cleans up the blood from the fallen assassins. Phoenix's iron exterior is scrubbed and buffed by a particularly advanced domestic robot. When they're finally finished, my apartment is even cleaner than it was the day I arrived. The last mechadome out closes my apartment door. Alone, I deflate a little. It's past dawn. The sun is bright. Phoenix toddles over from the drawing room toward me. I squat down and run my hand over its head. "You look better, Fee," I whisper, my voice a little shaky. Its rudimentary mouth curves up. I find my fusion blade where I left it upstairs in the bedroom. My own investigation of the lower floor doesn't uncover any monitoring devices left behind. On the balcony outside my apartment, the two hovering stingers guard the entrance. I use privacy mode to turn all the windows and glass doors opaque. Hunger drives me to the kitchen. I order a meal via the commissary unit located on the wall. When it arrives on a golden salver, I find that I'm afraid to taste it, worried that it's poisoned. Tears well up in my eyes. Phoenix lumbers in, the top of its head barely reaching the surface of the table. Lifting its vacuum arm, it delicately sucks in a few bits of pasta from the side of my plate. Humming and churning noises ensue. Words written in red laser appear in the lenses of its eyes, detailing a list of ingredients. I study it for a second, not understanding. Then I realize that Phoenix has analyzed my meal on a molecular level. Nothing about the list appears lethal. Its eyes return to glowing red. "You're sure this is okay to eat?" I ask in a soft tone. Its lenses move up and down in a nod-like gesture. I lift my fork, taking a small bite, and then a much larger one when I don't notice anything unusual about the flavor. Shoveling the food into my mouth, I finish the entire portion in a few more bites, hardly tasting it at all. We repeat the process for several more dishes and beverages until I have a small food baby in my belly and eater's remorse. "Are you Fee?" I ask, setting my fork aside. The burly mechadome's eyes move side to side. "Are you..." Using its right hand, the one that's like a claw, it lifts my hand and points to the small star on my palm. "Raken." I stiffen. "I'm going to bed," I murmur. "You should do the same." Leaving the kitchen, I trudge to the stairs and start to climb them. Behind me, Phoenix's feet clang against the floor. I pause, turning around to find the small bot running into the bottom step, trying to follow me upstairs. It points to the sofa, clearly wanting me to sleep there. "No," I reply, "I'm sleeping in my bed." More clanging sets my teeth on edge, but I ignore it. I take a quick shower and change into sleepwear that I can fight in if need be. The first aid kit in my bathroom has liquid stitches and bandages. I use the salve to sterilize and glue my frayed skin together, and a bandage to cover the wound on my neck. Returning to my bedroom, I climb onto the enormous mattress. I grip the silver hilt of my Halo Palace-issued fusion blade and, with supreme effort, try to keep my eyes open. A murderous nightmare leaves me breathless. I'm jerked awake by something brushing up against my arm. In my right hand, my fusion blade ignites, and I strike. But it's met by an equally strong dual blade, the X-16 model I helped design. The energy of our blades growls where they meet, spitting and sizzling in protest. "It's me," Reagan hisses between clenched teeth. The golden glow of the blade makes him look like a statue of an ancient deity, maybe even Tyburn himself. "You're having a bad dream." My eyes narrow, and I look around from my half-reclined position on my bed. My bedroom is the same as before, except the fat chair that's usually by the window has been moved to the corner. It has a small blanket draped over the arm and a large indention in the cushion. I withdraw my fusion blade and power it off. Raiken does the same. The soft light beside my bed illuminates when I touch its base. "What are you doing here?" I demand. Everything is hazy, and my voice sounds groggy, even though I have adrenaline coursing through me. My nightmare was particularly horrific. My mother's soldiers were destroying the city of Purity to get to me. Raiken retreats to the chair, lifting it and moving it back where it was. His hair is sticking up on one side, and his dark, expensive trousers are wrinkled. The broad expanse of his back is completely bare. He turns, and I see a large handprint on the side of his cheek. My eyes widen. "You slept here."
"You have bad dreams," Raiken grunts.
"So?" I ask defensively. "It's none of his business."
"So you sounded like you were being hurt."
"I wasn't." I rub the sleep from my eyes and sit up straighter, shifting my legs over the side of the bed and setting my feet on the floor.
"How was I to know?"
His lips curl in a snarl. "You refused to sleep on the sofa. I couldn't see you. Phoenix can't get up the stairs." He stretches his long arms over his head to work out a kink in his shoulder. His body is even more toned than those of most of the sword soldiers in my unit. He's perfect, except for a long, faint scar from his shoulder to his abdomen.
"Are you insane? You can't be found in my room."
"I know." He exhales deeply in frustration. "I'm going to have to stay until tonight when things become quieter. I'll sneak out then."
"I can defend myself."
"Unless you sleep through the attack. You didn't even hear me enter your room."
"I'm in more danger with you here. If someone were to find you in my quarters, it's not you they'll punish, it's me. Your firstborn." My tone implies all the malice I'm beginning to feel for all firstborns.
"Do what I tell you next time, and I won't have to come looking for you."
Raiken snatches up his discarded shirt. I lift my chin, realizing I've been staring at his bare chest. "Your shoulder healed well," I mutter. He has his arms through his sleeves, the material gathered at his elbows, ready to pull it over his head. Instead, he lowers his arms and glances at his thin scar. His irritation cools.
"The med drone you called on the battlefield mended my bones and cauterized my skin. It sterilized the wound and inoculated me against infection. It hurt like being branded by a fusion blade when I woke up in the back of the cargo ship that transported me back to a starbase."
"You didn't have the scar removed." "He could easily have done it. He's a wealthy, aristocratic star, a landowner, and a prominent member of the community that provides power and energy to the Fates. A Winterstrom." He shrugs into his shirt.
"No, I didn't."
"Why not?" He folds the small blanket, placing it on the arm of the chair.
"It's a reminder."
"A reminder of what?" He doesn't answer. I sigh. "How did you get past the stingers outside? Did you use lead to cover your moniker?" If he has more, I want some. I haven't yet fashioned a block for my moniker, and I need to be able to travel freely around without being tracked by the Virtue or anyone else.
"These aren't like sword stingers. These are Virtue's stingers, equipped with an arsenal of elite caliber weapons. Your leader saves all the best technology for himself. You can't just rely on a lead shield over your moniker. They have infrared."
"So, how'd you do it?"
"I created an orb that allows me to cloak my temperature. Used with the lead shield over my moniker, stingers can't ping me or sense me."
He pulls a small device from his pocket and hands it to me. It's a silver sphere the size of a walnut.
"What do you call it?"
The orb is icy to the touch. The cool sensation travels across my skin on contact. In seconds, I'm practically hypothermic.
"Nothing yet. I just made it."
"You just made it?" I ask agog. "How did you know it would work?"
"I didn't."
He snatches it back from me, powering it off and returning it to his pocket. but you were crying.
I was crying? I feel sweaty. I need his device back so I can get rid of my blush.
I thought someone was hurting you, he replies gruffly.
He looks away.
I think you should call it a phantom orb, I mutter, trying to change the subject.
Can you make me one?
No, he scowls, turning and leaving.
I follow him. Raiken switches on the lights with a holographic board in the hall. In the drawing room, the iridescent glow of a whisper orb draws my attention the moment I cross the threshold. The orb sits silently on the low table, its bubbles spanning the entire apartment. Raiken set up a perimeter to hide me in.
Why won't you give me a phantom orb? I ask, as I catch up to him in the foyer.
Because you'll use it. You're supposed to be Grisham's mentor. You're not to go snooping around the Halo Palace. You're not to do anything out of the norm. End of story.
He finds Phoenix inside the niche in the foyer wall, connected to a recharge station. He squats down and disengages the unit.
I talk to his back.
Maybe I don't want it for here. Maybe I can use it to go back to Swords. See if I can get a secret meeting with my brother.
Raiken lifts the heavy mechadome. Turning, he brushes past me.
Your brother will kill you. Didn't you learn that last night? Or even last week? You're not leaving Virtues. That's final.
You don't know that Gabriel had anything to do with what happened last night.
Don't lie to yourself.
If he did, it's because he's afraid of...
Gabriel should be afraid. I'll kill him if he comes near you again.
He sets the fat bot on the table in the formal dining area.
My brother doesn't love you. He wants you dead.
He lifts a silver case from a chair and places it on the table next to Phoenix.
You don't understand.
Raiken rounds on me, his expression furious.
What am I missing? He demands.
I place my hand over my heart and whisper past the aching lump in my throat.
I told you before. I love him. I feel for my brother what you felt for your little brother before they killed him.
Gabriel didn't take Radix's life. He didn't do that to you.
Census did that. The Fates Republic did that. You're condemning Gabriel for wanting to live. The same as I want to live.
Raiken's hand closes around the nape of my neck, gathering me to him. My cheek rests against his chest, and I stare at his bicep where it strains against his sleeve. I choke back tears, refusing to cry in front of him ever again. I'm surprised by his embrace, but at the same time, I'm not. Because we've saved each other's lives in the most harrowing of situations, I have a very visceral connection to him. A trust beyond what's rational.
That's not why I want Gabriel dead. Raiken says softly.
I want him dead, Roselle, because he'd rather kill you to save himself and his dying way of life than change and grow stronger to protect you. We're never going to see eye to eye on this.
I pull away from him.
No, we won't.
Raiken sighs.
Do you want to help me make some upgrades to Phoenix?
Aren't you afraid Grisham will wonder where you are?
I left word for the Firstborn Commander that I was going into the city to visit some establishments and wouldn't be back until tomorrow.
He faces the table and removes fasteners from Phoenix's hull.
What kind of establishments keep you out all night? I murmur, mostly to myself.
I pick up a tool and ease a fastener from Phoenix's side.
For a soldier, you're very naive, he replies, but there's a look of relief on his face.
I'm not naive, I reply with a sniff. I work with arms dealers and the underbelly of Sword Society.
Are you talking about some kind of betting establishment?
No, he replies. I'm talking about a pleasure house.
Oh, my spine straightens. Do you visit them often?
I want to bash him over the head with the fastener extractor in my hand.
No, it's just a cover.
I don't know whether I believe him. My frown says as much. He becomes angry again.
Those places offer the rape of secondborns who have no choice. If you know anything about me, know that. What do you think I'm doing here?
Okay, I'm sorry, I reply.
What exactly are you doing here?
I'm trying to change the world.
He's as intense as Dune. I could drown in the depths of his eyes.
Is that all? I ask with a small conciliatory smile. I thought you were here to make sure I do everything you tell me to do.
I'm overwhelmed by the firstborn star and his plan of the future. I even find it mildly amusing because it's so insane. His ambitions are in direct opposition to how I was raised, where conformity to the rules of the Fates Republic is paramount. He expects me to just switch my thinking and my loyalties to fit into whatever vision he sees this rebellion taking.
Making sure you do everything I tell you to do is just a bonus, he replies.
He's not joking. He's enjoying the power he has over me. One whisper from him in the right person's ear, and I'm dead. He could turn me in anonymously to be executed for treason. A rusted bolt slips from my fingers and clatters on the table. I reach for it, my fingers shaky.
What would you do if I stopped helping you? Would you turn me in?
He picks up the bolt, circling it between his fingers.
I would never turn you in, Roselle.
He gazes into my eyes.
You know too much. I'd kill you myself. You're too big a liability for me to leave your death in the hands of the Fates Republic.
I'm hard to kill.
Then I hope it never comes to that.
He hands me the bolt.
Do you want to learn how to install weaponry in a Class 5Z mechanized sanitation unit?
He holds up some parts from a disassembled hydrogen cannon.
Yeah.
We spend the next few hours upgrading Grisham's prank mechadome with several degrees of firepower. Midway through the upgrades, I order us some coffee from the automated food and beverage dispensary unit located on the wall in my kitchen. At the formal dining table turned workshop, we stand over Fee, sipping the steaming brew after Raken uses Phoenix's programs to test it for poison. The firstborn star explains that he installed technology in my mechadome that will allow him to see through Phoenix's eyes like real cameras and receive a regular video feed instead of just infrared images. I frown.
I'm not so sure I completely love that upgrade, I mutter, leaning my hip against the table edge.
Why?
Raken truly looks puzzled.
I'll have no privacy?
You'll see everything?
He shakes his head.
Would you rather be dissected on your sofa?
His eyes are blue, smoldering flames.
I thought they were going to slit your throat last night. I didn't know if Phoenix had the arsenal to stop them.
He points to the balcony.
If you hadn't woken up.
I stop listening. His voice just a noise. My throat tightens with the horrifying memory of fingernails dragging against my scalp. Panic seizes me with cold claws. My heart contracts painfully and then rages in accelerated flares. My skin instantly becomes clammy. I'm dizzy.
Are you okay?
Raken scowls and reaches out to touch my elbow. I yank it from him and back up a step, bumping into a chair and knocking over my coffee. It spills onto the floor. I hurry to the stairs, climbing them with my arm on the wall for support. In my bedroom, I retreat to the bathroom and close the door.
Shower, I croak.
The water in the glass enclosure turns on, but I don't get in. I want the sound to cover the panting that leaves me feeling as if I might pass out. At the sink, I whisper, "Cold water," and splash some on my face. My vision blurs. I clutch the enameled edge of the sink, lowering myself to the floor. Steam fills the room. Raken taps on the door.
Roselle?
His voice is low. I can't catch my breath enough to tell him to go away. The door opens. I start to rise, but my world tilts and I slide back down the wall. My hands go to my forehead. I'm trembling.
Am I dying?
Raken kneels in front of me.
I'm sorry I said that. His voice is soft and low. He strokes my hair. You're okay. I'm not going to let anyone hurt you again. I promise. I still can't breathe.
From his pocket, Reagan pulls out a silver case like the cigar case Clifton uses. Inside, it's different, though, with a secret compartment behind the narrow green cigars. From it, Reagan takes out a Chet. He tears off a corner of it.
Stick out your tongue, he orders. I'm only giving you a little. You can't take a full one again. You're too small. It'll wipe you out.
He places the small piece of Chet on my tongue, where it melts. Reagan sits down and puts his arm around me. I lean my cheek against his chest. After a few minutes, I can take a full breath again.
Better?
He squeezes my shoulder. I lift my cheek. I need a shower. Reagan helps me up. I'm weak, as if I just sprinted for miles. I shake off his hands, not meeting his eyes. I'm okay now. You can... I nod my head toward the bathroom door.
Oh, okay. You're sure?
He hovers closer to me.
Yes, I growl.
You don't want me to stay and help you into the shower? I glare at him.
What? He scoffs. I've seen you naked before, Roselle. Who do you think bathed you after I found you beaten half to death?
Out! I point to the door. He stuffs his hands in his pockets. After he leaves the bathroom, I take a long shower, trying to wash away the scent of fear. I'm relieved to find my bedroom empty when I exit the bathroom. I select a dove gray lounging outfit and dress quickly in the closet. I towel dry my hair and braid it in one thick plait. The sound of voices leads me to the den, where diamond-faded anchors on a visual screen report on preparations for the second-born trials. It's dark in here, with all the windows turned opaque. Reagan sits on the couch against the wall, his long arms resting on his thighs, his hands clasped, scanning the images in front of him as if he's searching for someone. I lean against the frame of the doorway. The sharp planes of his face have a blue tint from the light of the visual screen. The scene cuts from the second-born candidates registering for the trials. Reagan eases his back against the charcoal suede of the tufted couch. His hands absently rub the tops of his thighs. I enter the den.
What are you watching? I ask, sitting beside him on the couch.
Pre-trials.
Why? You can't possibly like them.
I don't. He gestures to the moving images in front of us. Ransom has skills. He's brilliant, and he's not half bad with a fusion blade.
You expect to see your brother register as a competitor?
His worried gaze shifts back to the screen. Like I said, Ransom's brilliant. He knows the odds of winning this travesty are slim, and he knows that, even if he were to survive it, he wouldn't come out with his soul intact.
You're assuming he got to keep his soul after his transition.
Reagan winces.
You kept yours.
Did I? I don't know if that's true. I'm different now. I'm not sure I'd make all the same choices I once did.
You know you did. You saved me on the battlefield when you could have killed me.
He picks up my hand, rubbing his thumb tenderly over my scar.
Fat lot of good it did me, I tease him.
You're worried he's like you. You'd risk everything not to be their slave.
I'm hoping he's not like me. Or maybe I'm hoping he's exactly like me. I don't know.
Reagan growls. He lets go of my hand and rubs his face where the shadow of a beard is forming.
I just want to see him again.
I hope you do. I rest my back against the soft cushions and pull my feet up next to me, leaning near him. He smells like lemongrass and a soft hint of cologne, the scent I remember from his bed in Stars. The peace of Chet relaxes me, not to the point of sleep, but enough that my head feels heavy.
How long has it been going on?
He pretends interest in statistics about would-be competitors on the screen.
What? I feign ignorance. Your panic attacks.
I shrug. I'm fine now.
How long?
I sigh. On and off for a while.